people should filter in shortly. So we're going to get into planning under uncertainty. There's two topics here that we're going to cover. Is the first is non-deterministic, and the second is going to be stochastic. The difference being the first one has no numbers, the second one has probability distributions. And the techniques are a little bit different, and you'll see why. So first thing we got to do when we're doing non-deterministic planning is we got to understand what is the distance we're calculating. And before, in classical planning, you're just calculating the distance between a single state and your goal state. And now in non-deterministic planning, what your search space looks like this, where you have what we call belief states, where you have a set of states that may be consistent with your current situation. So let's look at this domain. This is an extension of the classical domain. Where what I've added is I've added a statement in the initial state where you say one of the soils at one of these locations, and I don't necessarily know which one. And to come up with a conformant plan, I have to figure out a sequence of actions that'll make sure I've gotten the soil sample no matter where it could possibly be. So conformant planning is kind of like you're forcing the plan, every possibility, you're forcing them into the goal state. And when you're coming up with a distance metric, what you want to do is say, for all of these states, what does it take to get them to reach a goal state? They don't necessarily need to reach the same goal state, but they all need to reach a goal state. And as you can see, as you're doing the search, each belief state, you may have different propositions changing in the states, but you have several states still. And when you have uncertain actions, these number of states can grow as you apply actions. Here, the actions are just deterministic. So let's look at abstraction here, where we have two nodes we're trying to decide between which one we're going to expand and do the search under. The first one here we have two states in, and the second one we only have one state. And we want to reach one of these two states, which is our goal states. So what we're trying to estimate is these distances between a belief state to a belief state instead of a state to a state. So we've already seen in the previous part how to estimate the distance between states. We want to use the same idea here, but somehow account for the uncertainty. So the first idea, let's assume that we have these distances here we've computed with like a classical planning heuristic. You can pick your favorite one from the previous 2 hours. So we know that between this state and this state, it's going to be a cost of 30, and between this state and this state, it's going to be a cost of 15, and likewise for the other ones. Now what we want to do is pick for each of these states to estimate this belief state distance to this belief state. We want to figure out which state is this one going to transition to, and obviously we want to choose the minimal one. So we assume that this state's going to transition to this state, and this state's going to transition to this state, so we get the minimal cost. But now we have these costs for these different transitions, we want to somehow aggregate them in order to get the overall distance between the two belief states. And like we saw before in the classical planning, we aggregated the cost of these different goals. Much in the same way, we can aggregate the cost of the different states. What we could do is we could take the maximum. So for here, we say 15 is going to be the distance between this belief state and this belief state, and 20 is going to be the distance here. And we could do sum. Here we get 20, and here we get 20. So we wouldn't prefer either of the belief states. Another idea is to somehow get a measure of the positive interaction. So if this state is going to transition to this state, it may share some of the same actions that this state is going to use in the transition to the other goal state. And we want to somehow capture that to give you a better estimate of the positive interaction.
So intuitively, why would sum make any sense?
So if the states were completely independent, just like in the classical case, if all the actions that you use are going to be completely different from the actions that you use for the other state, then you would use sum, and it'd be very informative.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding. Those circles in the oval, those are actual states of the field.
Right.
So, but at any time, you're
Right, but you don't know what state it is. Because you have, in conformant planning, you have no observability. So the state of the world is hidden to you, but you want to...
The worst you could do is the worst... You know you're going to be in one of those states, and the worst that you could do is being in the worst of those states.
Right, and then in that case you'd use max. And that's going to be admissible if you use max, as long as these state distances themselves are admissible. And that way you can get optimal plans. But as we've seen a lot of problems, that the max isn't very informative.
But the intuition of non-interacting goals doesn't carry over to summing up states.
It's basically non-interacting state, in the sense, you know, if you were stuck in this state, what you would have done is basically completely independent of if you were in this state. Each state is a different assignment of values over the state variable. So if in this scenario you would do a plan which has no common action with the second scenario, in which case the right thing to do is add them up. So it is sort of state interaction.
Okay. Sort of like thinking of a uniform probability distribution.
Yeah, right now
in non-deterministic planning, that's one way to think of it, is that you, since you don't have a probability distribution, one way to think about it is it's uniform.
Yes.
But you know, in reality, there is no distribution. It could
right.
be any distribution. Yep. You have any other question over here?
Yeah.
So the idea is that you want to come up with a what we call a strong plan. That no matter what the distribution over these states is, you make sure that they're all going to reach the goal. And you can say that with 1.0 probability, you're going to achieve the goal. Later in probabilistic planning, we're going to relax that. But for now, it's every state's going to go achieve the goal. So I mentioned the union here. How would we go about doing this? Let's assume that we have some relaxed plans, that we have these actions appearing in different steps of a planning graph. To estimate the 15 and the 5 here. In order to get the union, what we can do is to count the overlap, or take basically the stepwise union of these two relaxed plans, and that'll give us an idea of what's positively interacting and what's independent. What we saw is that these two actions here are only going to be occurring in the second transition, so we count those, but then these other actions are common, so we only count those once instead of twice. So therefore, we get a measure of positive interaction and independence. This is similar to what we saw when we used relaxed plans in the classical planning case, where you get both a measure of positive interaction and independence. Okay. So this is a slide comparing the accuracy of these measures. What I'm showing here on number one is this: all of these points are the ratio of the optimal plan length to the estimate of the heuristic estimate of what the optimal plan length should be. You know, I'm estimating the distance between the initial belief state and my goal, and I'm taking the ratio of that with the optimal. So what we see is that with maximum, what actually happens is that we're always underestimating. Each of these segments here is a different domain, different conformant planning problem. And pretty much you're always underestimating when you're using maximum, which is what you would expect. It's giving you an admissible measure. When you use summation, you're typically overestimating. Not in all the cases, but pretty much overall. And when you use the union, you pretty much almost hit the optimal. So what we're going to do is we're going to develop this notion of the union, measure of union, to guide our conformant planner. So how do we go about computing this? I mentioned earlier that we could do this by using a single planning graph for each of the different states and computing the distance. Like back here, what I would be doing is computing a planning graph for this state, and then it would be actually measuring this distance for me with whatever heuristic I computed on that planning graph. So let's look at what these planning graphs give us here. For this particular problem, we list each of the states in the initial proposition layer, and then we construct the planning graph as we would in the classical planning case. Then we can identify, you know, a relaxed plan on each of these planning graphs. So now we need to combine these relaxed plans to give us a measure. So as I said before, you can do the maximum, which would give you 3, or you can do the summation, which would give you 8, or you could do the union, where what I do is I go at each level here and figure out which actions are in common. So I union these sets of actions that are chosen at each level. Here we see that communicate soil, this particular action is chosen in two of the planting graphs. So when I take the union, I only count it once. So I get one action for this layer, three actions for this layer, and three actions for this layer. So it's giving a measure in between the summation and the maximum. So I'm actually measuring positive interaction in terms of this action and independence in terms of the other actions. Okay? All right, so looking at this, this is pretty nasty because we have three planning graphs that have a lot of redundant structure among all of them. We have these drive actions and then these some of these similar propositions. And we want to somehow do better than this because in conformant planning, what may happen is that you may not know what your state you're in at all. So like we showed here, there's 2^2 S different belief states in your search space. And you know, the biggest size of a belief state is 2^S. And in that case, we'd have to build 2^S planning graphs. And each of them is going to be using a lot of redundant structure. So we want to somehow leverage this redundant structure and do as little work as we have to represent all of these planning graphs. And we developed this technique called the Lulled planning graph, where the idea is that we essentially union the structure of all of these individual planning graphs into one structure, but then propagate labels over the structure to indicate the different possible states that would use that in the planning graph if we were to build it explicitly. So what we see is that from here, we to form our initial layer, we have these three propositions that are different, but then we have this one proposition that appears in all of them. So what we do is we give it a label that indicates, I'm just using those little dots here to show which of the states it corresponds to. So add alpha is going to appear in all these states, so we give it a label that indicates every one of those. But then these propositions are only appearing in each of these single states individually. So what we want to do is propagate this information through the planning graph to tell us when our goals are going to be reachable from every single state. Because that's what we really want when we're measuring a conformant planning heuristic is what is the cost to get everything to the goal. And to do this in the planning graph, we can actually propagate these labels over the structure. The way that they're represented is they're propositional formulas. So this propositional formula here represents our initial belief state, which is saying that we have soil at one of these locations, and then we take the conjunction of this proposition with this formula. So this is going to capture all of the initial states where ad alpha is holding. Okay. So in order to do this propagation, we're doing Boolean function manipulation in order to compute the labels of each of these actions and propositions. So in order to do this, the first rule we do for actions is that an action is going to be only appearing in the possible worlds where all of its preconditions occur. So what we do is we take the conjunction of the labels of its preconditions. So here we have this red dot, and then here we have all three dots. And doing the conjunction, or just looking at them as a set, either the set intersection, the red one is the only one that's in the intersection. So you give that as the label of the action. Okay? And as we saw before, this sample soil alpha is only appearing in this planning graph. So we're not losing any information, we're just making it more compact. And it's not appearing in these other ones, and we're capturing that. So to label propositions, what we do is we take the disjunction of the labels of its supporters. So you're saying that in every planning graph where this proposition is supported, it is appearing in that proposition layer. So we see here, have soil is supported by three different actions, actually in no-op also, but you take the union to give it its label. And as we saw before, have soil is appearing in each one of these planning graphs at this level. So representing the same thing, just more compactly. Oh. Mm-hmm. Give me a break.
No, you have to do that.
Got it. So then we continue on labeling as we have doing intersections for actions, disjunctions for propositions, and then we get our goal here, which is being, we know that it's labeled by each of these, indicating that it's reachable in all the possible worlds, and then we can stop construction of the planning graph. I mean, this is like, we've talked before about different termination criteria. We can just stop when the goal appears, or we can keep continuing further until the labels of the propositions don't change. That would be level off for this particular type of planning graph.
That's kind of reinventing the HTML.
Yes. So you're saying the assumptions under which this proposition is reachable. Yeah. So what we want to do is pick up a relaxed plan for all of these possible worlds at once. As you saw before, we had three planning graphs. We do three individual relaxed plans, and then we aggregate them. That's still doing exponential work if we were to do that individually for each possible world one at a time. So somehow we want to do it all at once for all of the possible worlds. And there's another thing we can do here that's kind of interesting that's in addition to, related to what we did with the cost-based planning, where we use the cost of the actions to guide the extraction. Here what we can do is we can use the cardinality of the label to guide the extraction. So what that's saying is that if there's multiple ways to support this goal, I want to pick the way that's going to support the most possible worlds at once. And what that means is that I'm maximizing my positive interaction. I'm trying to find the way that will make all the worlds work at once together with the most positively interacting. So what I'll do is I'll pick up this action in order to support the goal, and then I need to support this action, so I pick up its preconditions. And then I have to support, say, this proposition. But there's no one action that's giving it in all worlds. So what I need to do is pick up several actions, more than one, to cover all the possible worlds. And you can think of this as a set cover problem, where this is a set of worlds where this proposition is reachable, and I need to cover it with actions that are supporting it in different worlds. So oftentimes you may have actions that are supporting, you know, different subsets of these worlds, and it's just a natural set cover problem, and we can just solve this greedily. I mean, you can do it optimally if you want to, but again, you're going to be going intractable. Another thing that's going on here is that you don't necessarily need to support propositions in all possible worlds. You only support them where you're going to be using them to support other actions. So you have to kind of keep track of, I'm using the size of the label to indicate whether it's being used or not. So I don't necessarily need to support all these propositions in all possible worlds, just the ones where I've actually used them. So this is a graph comparing whether this works or not. If, you know, condensing everything into Boolean formulas instead of representing them explicitly is actually saving us anything. I mean, the worst case complexity is actually the same. But if we can leverage the structure, if the planning graphs are not completely independent, then we've actually made some savings. So what I'm showing in this plot is, I'm showing a lot of stuff here. I mean, if you're going to build them for all possible worlds, which I'm showing at the very end here, building it for every node, or building a planning graph for each possible state in every node, you're going to take this much time to solve our suite of problems, which is about like 8 hours. And then if you use this labeled planning graph approach, it takes you about an hour to solve all the same problems. And another interesting thing that I didn't mention before, but when you're computing this heuristic and you have all these states in your release state, you can sample a subset of those and just use them as the heuristic. You don't necessarily need to compute them for all of the states. I mean, you're obviously going to be more informed if you use more of the states to compute the heuristic, but what we wanted to check whether you can actually get away with sampling a subset of them and using them to compute the heuristic. And what we found is that it does save us some time when we're computing multiple graphs, because obviously we're computing less of those multiple graphs per node. But when we use the labeled planning graph, we actually do better if we use more possible worlds, because we're getting a more informed heuristic and we're actually able to represent it better and make up for that extra cost of using more possible worlds. So what we've gotten is a way to compute heuristics for belief states, but what it's actually giving us is a way of representing multiple planning graphs implicitly versus representing them each individually. Like we talked about in classical planning, here where we're exploring the search tree, we're building a planning graph at every node. We could use the same technique with the label planning graph to represent all of these planning graphs that we're building during the search. Right.
Yeah, but doesn't it actually hinder the effectiveness of the formal approach using a single planning graph?
Can you repeat that last part?
Yeah. No. Sampling more words, will it reduce the effectiveness of the formal approach in which you have
the multiple planning graphs?
Yes.
It will improve the effectiveness when you're using very few worlds because you're reducing the cost of computing heuristic. But you're actually getting a less informed heuristic, so you're doing more search. I mean, this is what we've been talking about before, is that you have the balance between how much search you're doing and how much time you're computing the heuristic. And this is just doing, this is exactly evaluating that, whether spending more time in the heuristic or less time is actually buying you anything. And what we found is that if we use more worlds, we can spend less time in the heuristic and also get a more informed heuristic. Okay? Any more questions? So, what I was alluding to before about representing a set of planning graphs, we developed this in a technique called the state-agnostic planning graph, where, I'll show you a picture here. Let's say that each of these is a different belief state. I'm just using a different color to represent different states. What I can do is represent the planning graph for all of these belief states at once by just taking the union of their states. And then I know that for any set of states that I need a computer heuristic for, it's going to be exists as some subset of this planning graph. So if I were doing classical planning search, if I were to build this planning graph for every single state in the domain, all 2^s of them, then I know when I need to compute the heuristic for one of the states that it's going to exist in this labeled planning graph already. So what's happening is that I'm amortizing the cost of computing the heuristic, where up front I compute the planning graph for every single state at once. And then when I get to each node, if I visit enough nodes, then I'll have paid for the cost of that upfront construction of the planning graph. So what this looks like is we've built a planning graph where we've labeled all the actions and propositions, and I found that these are all the states in my domain. So that whenever I encounter a belief state that's a subset of the complete set, which I know is going to happen, then I can look at this planning graph and find the heuristic. So let's say that my search visits this belief state, which has these two states with these propositions, which are numbers. Then what you do is, when you go to support your goal here, you ignore this blue label because that's not one of the states in your belief state that's under consideration. So when you go extract the relaxed plan, is you just ignore the blue label at every node.
Why can you ignore it?
Because you don't care about it because it's not at one of the states in your belief state.
But it might be somewhere on the way, right? It might be that you have to go through.
And at that point, you will consider it. But here I'm just saying that this is a belief state that doesn't have it. So in order to compute the heuristic for this belief state, I would ignore that state.
Why is it a good heuristic? Why is it good to ignore it? It's definitely acceptable.
It would be during extra work that you didn't have to do. Because if that blue state is not part of my belief state, I don't have to worry about transitioning it to the goal. I mean, that blue state, it may appear in one of these proposition lists in the planning graph as one of the states that you think is reachable in the future, but it's being taken care of as part of the relaxed plan that you have to go through when you pick up the relaxed plan for these other states.
But you think of the scenario where you only have one state, right? You still, when you're computing the planning graph, that one state, it is essentially giving you approximate information about other states that you would be reaching on the way to the goal. So that is always there. The only thing that he is doing right now is the initial state itself could be either state 1 or state 2, and so you don't need to worry about starting from state 3, because for this, where you are, the number, the principle 2 is the number.
So what's going on is we're kind of building up a database of planning graphs, and we can just pick out the pieces we need in order to compute a query, which is just a computing a heuristic for a belief state. So here's some results showing how this works. What I'm showing here is that each point is a different problem in our suite of problems, and what it is the ratio between using the state agnostic planning graph versus computing the planning graph at every node. So if the line is the dots above the axis here, they're showing that this is the speed up, the multiplicative speed up in terms of using the state agnostic planning graph, where you compute all the planning graphs up front versus computing them as needed at each search node. And we see that most of the problems, it is a factor at least 10. And this is in where you have belief states in your space. So in classical planning, there is a speed up, but it's not quite as much. This is a scenario where you would be computing a planning graph at every search node, and you. Okay, so the point is, it's representing the ratio between the time taken to when you solve a problem using the state agnostic planning graph versus using a regular planning graph where you build it at each search node. Actually, it's reverse. It's planning graph over the reachable, the state agnostic planning graph. So all the points, the y-axis is showing the multiplicative speed up by building all the planning graphs up front and amortizing their cost over all of the search nodes.
What's the
runtime. So what this is showing is the problem takes longer to solve, the speed up is greater. So for the harder the problem, or the larger the search space, your speed up is greater. Well, we don't have any points under the axis, the ratio of 1, so that's good at least, albeit noisy. And then in the classical planning case, it's not as much of a savings because there is scenarios where using this building the state agnostic graph up front is actually more costly, because what happens is we don't pay for it because we don't visit enough search nodes that would actually, because our search space, we look at a very limited portion of it, and we would be paying off more of it if we looked at more of the search space. The reason that it pays off more when you have uncertainty is that even though you may visit a very small portion of the search space, the states that you visit you're going to visit a lot more states because there's belief states that contain those states. So you're actually looking at more states, but less belief states. Whereas in classical planning, you're only going to be looking at very few states if you have a good heuristic that's giving you good guidance. And then here we have some comparisons on some specific domains for conformant and conditional planning. Our technique is the one in the center here, highlighted in yellow, and we just want to identify that there's a trade-off in some of these domains. Some of them are there's a lot of uncertainty, and it's not quite the best approach. Like these second two have a lot of uncertainty, so there's a specific heuristic used by this planner that's a lot more efficient. Essentially what it does is it counts the number of states in a belief state as a heuristic. It's called a cardinality heuristic. What it's doing is measuring.
The horizontal axis here?
These are different problems, and the y-axis is the runtime. But what we find is this approach is pretty general. It works well in a lot of domains, whereas some of the planners we compared with, they work well in one set of domains, but they don't work well in the other set because it has a very specialized heuristic.
What's the size of the domain?
This last one here is called ring. It's a problem where you have a ring of rooms and you don't know which room you're in, and then it has a window in each room that needs to be shut and locked, and you don't know whether it's open or locked or anything. So you don't have no information about the domain at all. And you have to make sure that everything's, all the windows are closed and locked. So the belief, the number of states is about probably 20 million. And then the number of belief states is about 20 million. So the number of propositions is probably like 30 or 40.
I'm not sure I'm getting the design of the space and time. So you have this room, then you have the window, and you don't know which room you're at. You don't know whether there is the window is shut or open. You don't have anything that gives you observation, right?
Right.
So the only plan you have is just to
do everything.
Every
That's what conformant planning is to make sure you cover every case. And the reason that people have studied this is because if you have systems where you have sensors that break or they may be too costly to use, sometimes it's cheaper to use a conformant plan that doesn't do any sensing at all. So it's a backup. If your sensors break and you have nothing you can do, then you just come up with a sequence that'll always work. This is really popular with NASA kind of applications because they just want something that'll work. You can just look in the book and read down the sequence and it'll take care of the situation. And you don't have to have the astronaut up there trying to fumble with figuring out what to do, taking branches in the plan and making observations. Then this is some other conditional planning domains where we do better. So the idea here is we're extending the notion of positive interaction and independence to between states instead of between propositions. It's just another level on top of what we've done in classical planning. But what we had to do in order to do this was leverage the structure between these states and how they reach the goals. And if we can represent that very compactly, then it provides a savings. Yes?
Question. What if this would still be relaxed state we were talking about?
There's no mutexes, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. But once you did the labeling and you have negative interference, then you could use this representation for some sort of conflict-driven technique to it.
I'm not sure what you mean by conflict-driven techniques.
Well, you have the analog concept as notebook in the AGMS.
Yes, so what happens in this case is you would have generalization of the notion of mutations. Something in world X might be mutated in something in world Y. These are cross-world mutations, and it is actually possible to propagate them.
Yeah.
But in that long game paper that you mentioned, he tried it, and it just doesn't paper itself.
Okay.
Right, you have to do a case-by-case analysis for those kind of things. But you can actually, there's something I didn't mention where you can compute mutexes for inside each possible world, like for each of these individual planning graphs. You can compute all those mutexes at the same time and you have a big savings there.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Williams is doing this with
this
search-oriented approach.
Yeah, so one way of finding any kind of mutexes is let the search find it. So if you think of graph plan search, backwards that the graph plan can find you another mutexes. But then you're paying for it. You're essentially doing the full search to find what graph plan is required and more detail than all those.
The second question refers to observation actions and planning them. Mm-hmm. I mean, you assume you're not doing any observations.
Well, I have some results here. These are actually with observations in these domains. I didn't explain this, but so the idea is the reason you need to observe, I mean you must observe, is because of negative interactions. So let's consider you have a medical problem where if you give a patient a medicine and they don't actually have the disease, then they'll die. But if you observe it and make sure they have the disease, then and you give them the medicine, they won't die. So there's no conformant plan for this problem because there's an interaction between these two worlds where one case they're sick and one case they're not sick. So when you observe, you remove this mutex between those worlds.
No, I don't agree. Let's say in a diagnostic problem, if you don't observe,
then you replace all the suspect components. If you observe, you localize the fault better and replace
so
only
so
one component.
So I think that's why
so
I said you must observe. You don't have
for
to.
For reducing the cost, not only.
Yes.
The
right.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, like there's complete infeasibility, which would be infinite cost, where you observe to reduce it to finite cost, and then there's reducing the finite cost to a lower finite cost.
Right. If I knew more, then I could develop better plan for that cost.
Right. But you can use these same techniques just strictly by ignoring observations. And they do prove effective, which I'm showing in these plots here in these domains.
But is there any systematic work about combining the planning of observation and what you outlined here?
There's been well, no, there's a sensory graph plan, which actually builds planning graphs that includes information about what knowledge is going to be available at different time steps. But propagating that information is very costly, and it's not a very scalable approach.
And the other thing is sensory graph plan essentially winds up doing multiple extensional graphs, so it's like it is overhead in terms of. And then there's this one other point that I want to mention. There's an elephant in the room, which is you can solve all these problems with MDPs, and we'd like to hope that you know there is an MDP solver which can solve it. MDP is the general case of everything in the world, and PalmDP is of course general case of life. But the problem is, it just don't scale. I mean, I would love to have an MDP solver which solves a version of this these deterministic partial satisfaction planning problems, like deterministic just cost based planning problems. At anywhere level at par with the current,
I'll show you some slides in the next section, which I compare with the work that compared against a PalmDP solver that trying to solve some problems, and it's not even close in terms of scalability. I'll get to that. It comes with a caveat that you'll see. So any more questions before I move on?
Sure, but you could go on.
We can talk afterwards. Okay, so stochastic planning. What's going to happen here is that we have, before I had this one-off statement saying that one of these propositions is going to be true in my initial state, and now I have a distribution. I have the probability of each of these propositions being true. And also what I have is I have probabilistic effects of these actions. So when I'm communicating my data back to my lander, the communication may work or may not. And then when I have the sample, sampling may work with certain probability. And then what I have is I have a goal threshold saying I want the goal to be true with at least 0.5 probability. I mean, in practice, you actually want it to be higher than this, but just an illustration. There's also different formulations of stochastic planning where you just say, give me a finite length plan and maximize the probability of a k-step plan. But this is actually the indefinite horizon case where you don't necessarily know what the length of the plan is. You just say, give me a plan that exceeds this goal probability threshold, which is actually a harder problem. Okay, so this is what the search space looks like in probabilistic belief space, where it looks much like before, but we have distributions over these states that we may think we may be in. And then when we apply an action with a probabilistic effect, what happens is this particular action only applies to this first state. The other two states go unchanged, but what it does is it splits the state to one where the effect occurred and one where it didn't. And then you have a higher probability, you split the distribution, the probability mass between them. And so you're searching along and your belief states have these distributions, and now you want to know, what is the cost of taking my belief state that has that's characterized by a probability distribution and getting it to the goal with a high probability, above my threshold? And before, what we were asking is, what is the cost of getting every state to the goal? And now we just want to know, what's the cost of getting a certain probability mass to the goal? So, something that we didn't talk about in the non-deterministic case was uncertain actions. And here, we're just going to bring them directly in. And this is really the source of a lot of the problems in dealing with stochastic planning. Because what happens is that when you build the planning graph, there's going to be a split in the planning graph. Well, let me show you a picture here. So there's a planner called CGP, which does search on the planning graph, much like the graph plan planner for classical planning. And the way it represents the planning graph when you have uncertain actions is we have initial proposition layer for each of the states like we saw before. And then when you have this action, this sample action that has an uncertain effect, you get a proposition layer for when the effect occurs, and you get a proposition layer for when the effect doesn't occur. So what this is doing is representing how all the possible cases of how the planning graph could evolve when you have these uncertain actions. And here we have the next layer. I'm not showing how these other ones grow because it gets really broad really quickly. But I have two probabilistic actions, and now what I have is I have four proposition layers because I have to. There's a proposition layer for each joint outcome of these actions. So this is when both the communicate and the sample have their intended effect. This is when one of them has their effect. This is when the other one has their effect. This is when neither of them has their effect. So you can see if you're trying to explicitly represent this, like I was doing with the multiple planning graphs, you're sunk even worse. So we wanted to extend the label planning graph to this technique, or to this scenario where we have the uncertain actions. And as it turns out, what you have to do is when you introduce labels, before our labels were just capturing our uncertainty in our initial state, or whatever our belief state happened to be. And when we went forward, the labels, the size of the number of labels was constant size as we grew the graph. But now, if we want to capture these uncertain outcomes, we have to introduce new labels to represent how the planning graph split. So what you would have is you'd have a label saying, this is my initial state, and this outcome of this action occurred at this level, and this outcome of this action happened at this level, and so on. So if you know anything about like a Markov chain, if you're trying to represent the distribution over the state at different times with the Markov chain, it grows exponentially as you're going along. And in order to capture that, you're doing a lot of work. And we're trying to do this for a heuristic. So in order to exactly capture that distribution over these proposition layers, whether it be by a labeling or by exactly building it with multiple planning graphs, we're doing a lot of work that we don't need to do, just to compute a heuristic. So this is what it eventually looks like if you're doing the exact representation where you're showing all the splitting. I'm just showing these little nodes as the proposition layers, and these are the action arcs connecting them. And all these ones with dots are where the goals have been achieved. So this is kind of conceptually what the planning graph will look like. And we don't want to do all this work in order to compute the planning graph. So the idea is to use Monte Carlo to sample some of these planning graphs to give us an idea of which action outcomes are actually going to happen. So we start with our belief state, and we have our distribution over it, and we have a set of particles. And each of those particles will sample from this distribution of states and start building a planning graph. So we show the distribution of particles after one step. These are all the initial proposition layers. Each one is corresponding to one of these states. And the number of particles is, representative of what the probability of that particular state is. Okay? So when we put an action into this that's applicable to this proposition layer, it's going to have two outcomes. And we've sampled which outcomes are going to be occurring, and we get particles for each of those outcomes. And we continue to go on. And here we've seen that our goal is appearing in some of these proposition layers. And we can say, okay, we had 16 particles and 5 of the proposition layers actually have the goal in them. So we're saying, oh, the goal is going to be reachable with 0.31. But we had a threshold of 0.5, so we have to keep going. So now we have our goals reachable with 0.5. And we just went one step further. We didn't need to do that, but the animation did.
So you stop extending nodes that have only one particle?
You don't necessarily need to propagate the ones that the goals have appeared in, because the goals are going to be reachable later on.
Okay.
So you don't necessarily need to propagate it further.
So what happens if you have a single particle? I see that second from above on the surface.
Right here?
No, that one. Right. Yeah. So you did execute another action. What happens if you have stochastic spin?
You sample one of the outcomes for that single particle.
So you don't split.
Well, the only reason I'm splitting over here is because some of the particles sampled that particular outcome.
It's kind of a discretization.
Well, you could, but it wouldn't necessarily be effective. I mean, it's not going to capture this distribution over these.
I'm saying that if it was 0.55 and 0.45 and you couldn't fit the particle in the middle, then you get in discretized distribution.
Right.
Instead of using the true distribution, you get discretized.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. But remember, we're computing heuristic. So we can use this approach. And the nice thing about using a Monte Carlo is that we can choose the number of samples we want, and it cleanly traded off the amount of time we're using a computing heuristic with the informedness of the heuristic. If we use more particles, we take more time, but we get a more informed heuristic. So now we still have multiple planigraphs as we are right now, and we want to use the same sort of labeling technique to summarize all of these planigraphs, and it's very straightforward in order to do this. So let's start over with our belief state, and we have just four particles we want to use right now. So what we do is we sample, for each of these particles we sample a state, and then we use those states to form our initial proposition layer. And if you notice, one of these states wasn't sampled because it had very low probability. And that's okay if that state doesn't appear in the planigraph. So then what we do is we label each of these propositions with the sample that happened to be sampling it. So this one is appearing in each of these states, so it gets labeled with all the samples. And the other ones were only appearing in a couple of states, so they get those samples. Okay, so we use the same sort of semantics in order to propagate labels. And what we do is we take intersection or conjunction over the preconditions of action. So we see here that we have all the particles labeling this proposition and only two of them labeling this proposition. So intersecting these two sets gives us these two propositions for the action. But now, this action has a probabilistic effect. So what we have to do is sample which of these particles are going to be labeling that effect. So it happens that the red one here is the only one that happens to sample it, whereas the gray one samples the other outcome, which is no effect. So the outcome gets labeled with that particle, and then the proposition it supported gets labeled with that particle again. Okay? So the only thing that's happening here that was different than the previous labeled planigraph is that we have to sample the outcome of the action for every particle labeling the action. Alright? And let's see. We can do the same trick to count what the probability of supporting the goal is. Here we know that it's 1/4 because we only have one of the particles labeling it. So we go a step further, and now we have 3/4 of the particle labeling it. And we think we may be able to support the goal with 75% probability. And then we got to pick up a rocks plan in order to support the goal with all of these particles. And we don't necessarily need to pick up actions that contain this other particle that's not labeling that goal. So like we discussed before, you pick up the actions, and I mentioned before that we're guiding the extraction with the size of the labels. When we have multiple supporters for a proposition, we want to use the actions that support in the most possible worlds. And here it has a very direct meaning, which is just the probability. So we want to pick up the actions that are supporting that proposition with the most probability. And it's measuring positive interaction of probability mass. Okay. So using this, we have some nice results where what we're comparing with is a planner called CP Plan, which is based on CSP encoding of conformant probabilistic planning. And what it does is it essentially solves the suffixes of a conformant plan in order to get a heuristic, or it bounds the probability of reaching the goal. So it's estimating, it's exactly computing the probability of reaching the goal, whereas we're estimating it with a heuristic. And it's also a finite, bounded length planner. So it says, give me the maximum probability plan for one step, or for two steps, or whatever steps you provide. And so what we did here is we said, I'm showing CP plan in this black dot here, where the y-axis is the time taken, and the x-axis is the probability of satisfying the goal.
And the 2, 2, 2, 2, 5, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2
This is a logistics problem. And at once to find a one-step plan, I think. This is the length down here of the same problem. So the time taken and the length of the plan. So I think this is an 8-step plan. It finds a plan that satisfies the goal of maybe 0.1 probability. And then for the next, a 9-step plan, it finds one for 0.15 and so on. And it's actually optimal because we're finding the maximum probability to reach the goal for a given step length. And then what we did is we took our planner and we said, okay, whatever probability it reached at this level, let's try to exceed that probability and find a plan. So if it found a plan for 0.05 probability, we said to our planner, give me a plan that achieves the goal with more than 0.05. And that's what we're plotting here is, for the same level of probability that the other planner found, what was the time taken in order to for us to find a plan that exceeds that probability, meets or exceeds. So as we see, the other planner, it has exponential growth and is dying around 0.25 probability on this problem. And the length of the plan is about 10 actions. Whereas our planner is going out to about 0.95 probability, and the length of the plan is about 30 or 40 actions. And the reason it's dying is that it's having to deal with the length of the plan as it grows, and it has to do all this extra work in order to find longer plans. Whereas using a heuristic, it's able to jump deep into the search space and direct you in the right direction. So we also have a couple other domains which are different variations on the logistics problem where we see the same kind of behavior. And what's interesting is that we can solve to much larger probability, but the length of the plans is not necessarily that much worse. It's a few actions in most of these cases. And this is what we were trying to say before about the using computing heuristics, is that we don't necessarily want the admissible heuristics because we're not going to scale. But if we use something that's close to the perfect heuristic but is not guaranteed to be admissible, then we can scale much better, but we're not guaranteed to be optimal, but it's close. So this is another domain. It's a grid domain where there's a robot trying to navigate from one corner of a room to another, and it has no sensors. And when it moves, it may move in the adjacent directions with a small probability. So when it's moving around, its belief state's growing slowly and thinking it's everywhere in the room with a certain probability. And in order to, the computing planner is only available to solve this for, it's a 10 by 10 grid, and it only gets about 0.05 probability, and our planner can go all the way out to 0.85 because it's using this type of reachability heuristic. And let me see, they compared the CP plan people compared with a PomDP solver on this particular problem, on the previous ones also, and the PomDP solver could only solve the plan if the robot started only a few square, like, so if it's a 10 by 10 room and you start out at square 10, 10, and you got to reach 0, 0, the PomDP solver could only solve with a reasonable probability at, like, 8 steps from the target position. So, I think they used PomDP solve, which is Tony Cassandra's. I think they used incremental pruning. But, I know. It
really doesn't work.
Right. So
that's like me trying to compare against graph.
Right. So PomDP solvers aren't necessarily meant to solve these type of problems where there's no observations, and
I agree.
So it is kind of apples oranges, but it does show you how much better you can use by cutting some corners with using a heuristic versus exactly computing an optimal solution, albeit by an older technique. And what we did, this is another variation on that same domain where we made the transition function a little bit more stochastic, where moving in the adjacent directions happened with higher probability. And what we found is that by using more particles, all of these lines are just using different numbers of particles to compute the heuristic. And by using more particles, we actually were able to solve this problem.
You're saying that the probability is 0.5
You're moving in the correct direction. And then 0.25, you're moving in the adjacent.
Oh, okay. So I'm not moving backwards.
No, it's just three directions. Yeah. So what's going to happen is your belief states are going to be more spread out and very non-peaked. And when you use more particles, it's easier to capture that distribution and give you a better heuristic. So using this technique, it's very difficult to select the right amount of particles, which is true for any Monte Carlo algorithm. But we found that you can get away with very few particles in a lot of these problems. We're using like between 4 and 32 particles in each of the planning graphs, which is probably pretty surprising to people that do inference with Monte Carlo. Okay. So, to conclude this part, the number of joint outcomes when you are building this planar graph is too large, so we just sample them, and it's able to actually capture the ones that we care about because of the high probability outcomes that we're going to have to use in our plan. And if we're missing some of these action outcomes or the branches of this planning graph, then it's okay because we might have captured them in some of the other branches anyway. Okay. So what do we have? We have 40 minutes? Okay, so we'll quickly go over planning with resources and planning with time. Here I'm going to step back. There's no uncertainty at all. This is like we're coming from classical planning, and planning with resources, what's happening is that your propositions aren't Boolean valued, they're going to be real valued or continuous. And how do you cope with this in the planning graph? So this is just the simple domain where each of these actions uses some amount of power, and they'll decrement or increment the power. There's a recharge action which just has the rover sit there and collect solar energy. So when we have the proposition that, or the variable that's the continuous one is power, and we want to track information about what are the reachable values of power in the planning graph. So we know that power starts out at being 25, so we keep an interval on what is the reachable values of power. So it's just 25, 25. And if you think about like a naive way of tracking the reachable values of a continuous variable, what you could do is just insert a proposition in the planning graph that says power equals 25. And then if you do an action that decrements power, you say power equals 20, power equals 30, and represent it that way. And what will happen is that your proposition list will become very large very quickly because there's all these different ways of decrementing or incrementing a particular resource. So the trick that we use is we just represent it by an interval. So we're saying that within this interval, this value is reachable, and you don't have to, it's a big savings over just representing all the reachable values, and it's consistent with what the planning graph does, is it over approximates what are the reachable propositions and values and actions. So it's okay if we use an interval that contains values that are not reachable, because we're over approximating, and that's what the planning graph is supposed to do. So at the next level, what we do is we update both the upper and lower bound on this variable. Because we have some producers and some consumers of the resource. We have these two actions here that consume and this one action that produces. So you increase the upper bound by the max that you can produce, and you decrease the lower bound by the max you can consume. So you know that this power variable is going to be within that interval. But there's many values within there that aren't reachable because it's just not possible given the actions that you have. So you can continue to propagate this information, and then when you have actions that rely on a resource, you have to make sure that these actions in here, they have an inequality in the precondition saying that power is above a certain level in order to execute them. So all you do is when you have an action that with a resource precondition, you just make sure that it's within that interval from the previous level. So this is just restating. And then you continue until your goals are reachable, which is fine. I mean, you can also have resource goals where you want to make a resource above a certain level, and then at which point, in order to check that the goal is actually satisfied, you have to make sure that that level you are, that's in your goal, is reachable within that interval. Okay, so in order to extract a relaxed plan when you have resources, I mean, you could obviously use your level heuristics just as very straightforward, where you check to make sure that the level that you care, you check to find that that level is in a particular proposition layer, and then you say that that's the level of that proposition. So we start extraction of a relaxed plan as before, and we need to make sure that we keep track of how much resources are being used. So if we're using this action here to support one of our goals, and we have to, it's supported by this resource precondition, we have to keep track of how much is being used of that resource, and then make sure that when we support that resource, we pick an action that gives us enough of that resource. So we can do this here with this persistence. So let's go a little further. Oops. So now, what we've done is we have these two actions here, which actually require quite a bit of resource, which is, it takes a total of 30 power to support both of these actions. And we need to pick actions to support the power that gives us at least 30. But it could be anywhere in this interval, so we need to make sure that we have enough. So what happens is we pick both the persistence of the power from the previous level, and we choose this recharge action in order to make sure that the resource has an appropriate level for what was ever required at the later levels. And we saw this before in the planning under uncertainty, where we use multiple actions to support propositions. This is similar, where we have a certain requirement that isn't met, and we need to make sure that we have enough to support it. So then we get our relaxed plan like we had before. We count the number of actions, and that's our heuristic. This is just showing some plots of results of planners that use this type of technique. FF, metric FF was the one in green here that uses this particular technique. This is some IPC problems. So the main trick that we use in planning with resources is to represent the interval instead of all the reachable values. And in that way, we can over-approximate what are the reachable values, but we keep our overhead really low because all we're remembering is the interval versus all the values. And the other thing that we have to do that's a little bit tricky is when we're extracting relaxed plans, is we have to maintain what is our resource needs that we need to meet with when we support it with other actions.
But I don't see it. This is a very special treatment of the resources. Why not just treat them as some preconditions, some propositions or variables, and incorporate that into your normal representation of planning algorithm?
In essence, that's what he's doing, except continuous quantities do need intervals of representation. Otherwise,
sure.
You're just finding a...
So,
for example, there are like two extensions, starting from Boolean variables. You can kind of multi-value discrete variables, which is very easy to consider, but then you'll be talking about, you know, supersets of possible values that this guy can achieve by then. Then once you have continuous variables, you're better off with intervals. The other interesting thing is when you have negative interactions, what happens is the intervals get split. You know, if you want to exactly represent them, I mean, you are saying anything between -5 and +1000 is possible, but then when you start looking more closely, then you realize that -4.25 is possible, and then again +1 to +3 is possible, and so on. So it's just that's where you're getting more of the. I mean, the more information you have, the more you have about the splitting up within the world. Sort of connected to things like the disjunctive temporal constraint satisfaction problem, where again you look at,
yeah, so it's very common in temporal planning to also have resources, which we call metric temporal planning, but I'm just going to cover what it takes in order to incorporate time and durative actions. Because previously all of our actions are just atomic time, where you just execute them and there's just basically no lag between the time. And here, it's a lot more like scheduling, where you have actions that have durations. The main thing that we need to do is, okay, we have this temporal model here, where each of these actions has a different duration. And I need to talk a little bit about how you do search for these types of problems. Where before in classical planning, you just had to represent what your state is, and then you could apply actions to that, and you could figure out what the next state is. But when you have temporal actions, you may need to start several actions at the different times. So when you have a state, when you're searching and you have these different states, you may have started some actions that are going to span several time steps, and another one that starts spans fewer time steps. And these action, this time step that you're planning for, each of these states has a different time step. So this is going to be time zero, this is going to be possibly time one, and you need to figure out what the time is that you're looking at your plan in order to figure out where to place the action. So,
can't you artificially break the long action into, like, let's say an action that takes three time steps into an action, into three actions that take one time step and each one has a three
continuous versus three time is the issue. So, because in fact, the normal temporal planning allows continuous time, so you can't really, you know. So I think one of the points that he's trying to make here is upfront, if you're just thinking of doing prohibition style planning, when you have temporal planning problems, upfront it doesn't even look like it's feasible, because you have to consider starting the action at every possible real time point. And it turns out that there are ways of getting around it, but it's not just discrete. I mean, discretizing it will basically, you know, will make sure that the kind of idea you're saying is assuming that time comes in discrete pieces.
Yeah, but you are always saying that you want to compute it in heuristics, right?
Yeah, no. So here he's explaining the
plan. This is the search. This is the search, not the.
And then he's going into heuristics.
Why isn't time just another resource? Yeah, you could take your previous approach and make time a resource.
Because you have concurrency.
You cannot recharge time, that's special, but otherwise.
So at the risk of throwing in one more paper advertisement, on Friday morning, there is a paper titled When is Temporal Planning Really Temporal? And that actually answers the exact question as to why can't time be just fast? And so if it is, so it turns out that concurrency between actions is what separates two, I mean, that winds up being an important issue. If every plan for solving this problem must require actions to be concurrent, then time cannot be handled just as fast. Okay, so it's a good point. And in fact, one of the points that's made in that paper on Friday is many current day competition temporal planners which win temporal planning competition could really have been doing classical planning with time as fast, because they are not complete for true temporal planning problems. Okay, that includes some of the stuff that we need to do. But it's a good question. It's very much interesting.
Right. So I was describing the search space that you use to find these temporal plans, and it's a little bit different because when you're constructing a temporal plan, there's the particular approach I'm describing, we use forward chaining in order to construct a plan. So at every search node, what you're doing is you're deciding whether to advance the time in which you want to insert an action, or you decide on a new action that you want to insert in your plan to start right now. So each state actually has a timestamp that tells you what is the current time that's under consideration. And it also tells you what actions have I started at this time point so far. So when you're constructing, doing reachability analysis, you also have to reason about not only what is logically true in your state right now, but what you've committed to making true in the future, because you have all these temporally extended actions that have started right now, and their effects are going to happen later on, but you have to somehow remember those, and that complicates how you would do the reachability analysis in the planning graph. So I'll just show you what a planning graph looks like in temporal planning, where we have our same initial state as before, and then we have all of the actions that are applicable, and I'm representing their duration. And we can't necessarily use the same sort of leveled approach that we used in the previous classical planning graphs, because each of these actions has a different duration, and they just possibly span levels, or so the idea is that before, all we needed to know about the propositions and actions is the first time step in which they appeared. So the same thing we can do here is we just keep track of when was the first time that these actions appeared in the planning graph, and what was the first time that the propositions appeared. And then we can construct the planning graph in much the same way, but you just have to remember that the effects of the action may only occur after a certain delay from when the action started.
How would you model a continuous process that the effect was incremental, you know, as a function of time?
Well, we're not considering processes in this case, but you certainly could do that. I think you would just have to break it into separate actions to represent the incremental effect.
So there is actually a good news in what you just said, which is bi-level planning graph, which was just a kind of an optimum efficiency hack for classical planning, comes naturally as a fit for temporal planning, because you still have an index for each action and the position accepts this index is not a real number instead of a discrete number. So that just tells you what is the, you know, real time at which it came in. And so that lines up basically, and so with respect to that you can still do relaxed plan extraction.
Yeah.
You have to finish one action before doing another action?
No, not necessarily. Unless they
drive and send the image back, communicating.
Right,
In terms of search, in a progression, you only have the issue of I can do this action, then do this action, etc. In a temporal planning, you have essentially two decisions. Decision one is, should I do actions at the current time step or should I advance the clock? Decision two is, you know, having decided to, you know, either to stay at this time step or the next time step, which action do I do? Okay. So
once every second you make a decision whether to take an action or not. Yeah?
Yeah, so that's going to be an approximation. It turns out that if you're doing that, that's like doing discrete, you know, discretizing time. That's a reasonable idea. But I mean, it turns out the one of the things that, you know, in the previous slide, an example, a way of doing temporal planning is essentially just expand, you know, consider advancing the clock only when some effect has, you know, some action has ended, some event has taken place, which winds up allowing you to do.
Let us assume that we have the plan, like we have the timeline, right? And the points on the timeline which are marked with action. Okay, that's the plan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's continuous because the point is followed everyone. I'm asking, how do you execute? How do you expect the robot or whatever to execute?
So the start time is the only thing that you care about. If the plan says start this action at this time, you start it, and then it will take its own time and end. So we are assuming that the durations are fixed for all the actions. So once you start it, it will take its time and end. So the plan essentially is a dispatch which tells you at time 2.37 start A1, at 2.37 also start A2. 2.39 start A3. So that's basically
your execution. Okay. So given that we've able to construct a planning graph just by representing the time points when everything starts and whenever you get the propositions, all you need to know is the first starting times. You don't necessarily need to know when they can start again, because if you start this particular action here, you can start it at every particular time step afterwards. So we just remember the first. Then when we want to get a relaxed, so level heuristics in this case are measuring make span instead of level of the planning graph. Before we were making this assumption about concurrency, which is probably more realistic in temporal planning, but there you were measuring the number of actions, but here it's measuring the total duration. You may not necessarily know how many steps are in the plan, but you know the total duration when you use a level heuristic, which would just be the level at which all of your goals would come in, or the time when all of the goals would come in. And then in order to get a relaxed plan, which I'm showing down here, is you assume that all of the goals are supported at the last possible time, and then you pick actions to support to support those goals, and then you assume that they're starting at the latest possible time. And then when you support their preconditions, you use actions that have started they're given their effects before that time point where you need them. So all of these actions that you've chosen here have appeared earlier in the planning graph, and then you continue on until you've supported all the preconditions.
So one thing that I guess that is the level heuristics, which we kept saying would not be very effective in the classical planning because they only count steps. The analog of steps in temporal planning, it actually makes sense. And that is actually a very useful thing. So, you know, if you're only interested in just optimizing the plan and don't care about cost, then level heuristics are getting you that information. And one other thing, of course, is even in pure temporal, even in temporal planning, you might want to do make span as well as cost optimization at the same time. And that's when you actually need to take relaxed plan into consideration, because you need to see how the cost is interacting with the make span. You know, if you give me so much more units of cost, then I can get you shorter make span, for example.
Right. So, yeah, you can. There's two heuristics you can compute, the make span and the cost. And you can use the same sort of cost propagation techniques in the temporal planning graph that we showed in the classical planning graph. It's just each time point, what you have is you have cost functions that are going to decrease over time, but they're not necessarily decreasing over levels.
Just a detail. How can you sample soil at alpha if you are driving from alpha to gamma?
Because I'm ignoring the negative interactions.
And we are in the heuristic level.
Right, negative interactions get a lot harder to track when you have anything beyond classical planning. So we don't really cover that. I mean, it can be done. There's papers that describe it. But in terms of computing heuristics, it's dealing with the complexity of the added problem features is much harder. And just computing a reasonable heuristic takes a lot more time. So taking that extra time to compute the mutex is going to probably not pay off as much. Okay, so here's some results showing this particular technique for computing plan graphs or computing heuristics on some IPC problems. So the generalization we had to make in temporal planning was levels become time points. And you have a difference between measuring make span and plan cost, and you need to make sure you measure the right thing for what you're trying to do in your search. So, do you want to, we have 20 minutes, or we wanted to finish early, right? Did you want to go over that other stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So, I mean, let me try to, I think we have a few more minutes, and let me try to just put some of the unifying themes, and then you can ask me you can ask more questions, and then, you know, filling time has never been a problem for us. So one thing that, even before coming to this overall conclusions, is that, so we started, let's look at what we did. We started essentially with, you know, classical planning, right? And sort of started extending it to various types of problems, and for each of the types of problems, I mean, there's the issue of how do you do search, which is an open issue of course, okay? And then much of this tutorial is how do you do that search faster, okay? So in a way, in many cases, we had to, for example, when he was talking about temporal planning, he was trying to explain to you first how to do temporal planning so that then he can explain to you how to do it faster, okay? So in some sense, heuristic development has been going sort of hand in hand with as looking at more complex planning problems. Starting from classical planning, the way you can look at more and more complex planning problems is giving up on various types of assumptions. You can give up on the assumption of determinism of the actions. You can give up on the assumption of, and so if you do that, you get either non-deterministic or stochastic planning. You can give up on the assumption of observability, in which case you get, you know, conform and conditional planning problems. You can give up on the assumption of cost. All actions being equal cost, in which case you have cost sensitive, or all goals being required, you'll start getting partial satisfaction. One interesting thing that's happened in that community till now is there's been progress done on removing one assumption at a time. So classical planning, remove cost assumption and just handle how to deal with that. or remove instantaneous action assumption, which will just give you pure temporal planning, talk about how to deal with it. Or remove discrete state variable assumption, and so consider continuous state variables, and so just how do you deal with planning with resources. So the tutorial till now essentially took that same track. Okay, and a very obvious question should be, why not give up all of them? You know, why not say there is no determinism? So you have you have stochastic, continuous resources, a cost, and partial satisfaction, and so on. One of the things that's happening in the community right now is part of the reason it hasn't been done is scalability. Okay, so we really do not have yet good enough leverage on solving problems when you have multiple assumptions being removed. Okay. There is some progress being made. For example, in the case of temporal planning, the discussion that Dan did mostly was about, if you think of temporal planning, what you want to optimize is what? Make plan. But then really, even in temporal planning, actions have costs. And so all of you know that if you pay more money, you could have been in India faster, and if you paid less money, you got, shown the world and then you came here. And so really, when you give up both, so when you are talking about time as well as differing action costs, what happens? So some of the issues that come up, there in the AI magazine paper, which is not there in the tutorial, we have a section essentially describing what happens when you have these hybrid scenarios where you are giving up on multiple assumptions at the same time. Again, that work is sort of in its infancy. Some general points are that, for example, in the case of SAPA, so in the case of temporal planning, you wind up having multi-objective optimization problems. So because you really have make-span optimization as well as cost optimization. Okay, so you're no longer talking about single objective, but multi-objective optimization. So you have to first decide, do I want to combine the multiple objectives into one single utility measure, which is one way of finessing the multiple objectives, okay? Or you want to deal with Pareto set sort of thing. That's at the base level itself. But from the point of view of the heuristics, in the case of SAPA with temporal planning and cost, what winds up happening is you can estimate cost and you can also estimate time. That makes sense separately from cost. What's important is when you're doing cost-sensitive temporal planning, you need to sort of see how the estimates of cost interact with the estimates of time. So what you'll wind up actually getting are things called cost functions, which are essentially, how the cost changes as you give more and more time. Okay, and in most problems, obviously, in problems where there are no exogenous events, as you give more and more time, your cost can only reduce. Okay, more and more time being, you're giving as this much time, so what's the best plan you can find? And so your cost can only reduce. Okay, so that's one thing. So you wind up taking interactions between the different objectives. So you'll have to kind of estimate them in tandem. Okay, there's a separate issue of how do you combine these objectives. That's just a general multi-objective optimization issue. Okay, you can either, do this elicitation from the user saying, oh, if I were to think alpha times cost plus beta times, make span is what you're looking for, what's your alpha and beta? Okay, or you can do Pareto set. A couple of other things that, we have 10 more minutes. So let's just actually look at a couple of other higher level points. So I think one other thing that I wanted to mention is, a couple of times during the tutorial we used we in the sort of a inclusive we, that is we in the planning community as a whole sometimes, and we as in our group sometimes. So I just want to give you a feel for whether reachability heuristics of the kind that I'm describing here are just in my group or whether it is in the entire planning community. One important issue to understand, the reason this is interesting is, in fact, there's a lot of planners out there that are actually using reachability heuristics. So there is, I think, in the AI magazine paper, we have some statistics on among what?
Two-thirds to three-quarters of the IPC.
Yeah, two-thirds to three-quarters of the planners that participated in the international planning competition in the most recent time, wound up using reachability heuristic some type of or other, and many of them essentially use planning graph oriented heuristics. So there was an issue. Some places, you know, of course, a lot of this work actually we did in our group, but there are also a lot of other work that has been done. So for example, the interval propagation over the planning graph is an idea for the continuous resources. That's an idea that Hoffman developed in Metric FF. And similarly, relaxed plans idea was first developed by Hoffman in his FF planner. Okay. So what we tried to do is actually combine all of them, but there is this inevitable issue of you getting confused as to which V are we talking about. So I just wanted to give you an idea that you just didn't find out only about our group's work. It really is the sort of state of art in terms of scalable planners right now in our planning community. Okay. So let's look at some overall conclusion. Yes, sir.
I thought that there was I'm not really familiar with that use a different kind of relaxation. Like if you try to find the cost planner, then you solve the classical planning problem and you use the solution of the classical, you know?
You can use it, yes. I mean I'm sorry, I meant to say
in fact
there are versions of conformance planners which essentially, you know, for conformance planning, you can ignore all the state uncertainty and use the classical planning solution as the conformance planning solution. We have tried it, and I think other people have tried it too. You know, some of these relaxations are working, some aren't working, and you know, the working here is sort of an empirical issue. You know, you actually have to run over a large enough benchmark space. Yes. So you use classical planning's optimal solution as the heuristic for a conformance planning problem. Yes, it can be done. I don't know of anybody who has shown that as an effective state-of-the-art conformance planning technique.
We did those experiments.
It doesn't work as well. It looks great on, I mean, it is something that we tried. So in fact, you know, when you talk about relaxation, again, this is a reasonable idea. But it turns out relaxations that keep some aspect of some aspect of the belief spaceness with them wind up seem to be, you know, faring better than relaxations that give optimal problem for an optimal plan for a problem that completely ignores the state uncertainty. Okay? Again, I wouldn't have guessed it. If we could guess it, he wouldn't have done those experiments. You know, so, but again, open issues are what sort of other relaxations that you're going to deal with, and these negative interactions, as you saw across the tutorial, you know, negative interactions are things, you know, are actually possible to propagate. Mutual exclusion are possible to propagate for classical planning. Even in classical planning, they have been useful in classical planners as a way of adding penalty to relaxed plan heuristics. Okay, that sort of an idea could be useful for other scenarios. You know, some of these places where temporal planning as well as conformant stochastic planning places. We haven't tried it, but it clearly is the case that. So, in fact, as an anecdote, after FF success, FF is this planner that won the 2002, I think, planning competition.
The first one.
After that, everybody assumed systematic search in planning is sort of closed. Nobody can do faster. And then I think after that came FF downward, or fast downward, which essentially does better than FF. And a way of understanding its performance, again, is to see it as adding a penalty, which is based on negative interactions, to relaxed plan heuristics. Okay, so taking negative interactions into account, but doing it in sort of a limited way so that you won't pay too much effort is an open issue. I think it's worth considering. Okay, so overall conclusions are essentially that relaxed reachability analysis has been very useful, and as I said, you know, most planners in the competition level are actually using it. And many of them concentrate on the positive interactions, and when they take negative interactions into account, they add them as penalties outside. Okay, this should not be surprising to you because, as I pointed out, even in the classical planning, if you try to find relaxed plan which doesn't have negative interactions, you just solve the planning problem. So it's not a heuristic anymore. Okay, so it would be as costly as planning itself. Okay. The other things are, so the heuristic, and there are ways of aggregating the costs of the literals using either set level or relaxed plan extraction. And we saw how they vary as the planning problems change. Okay. The other thing is we could propagate, the planning graph structure has essentially interesting ways of extension so that you can propagate all kinds of information on it. We propagated, of course, just the reachability, achievability. Then we propagated cost. Then we propagated intervals over resources. We propagated labels, which are, you know, different worlds and how they wind up leading to reachability of different pieces of information, different propositions being thought. Okay, and this is this last part. This last part is what I mentioned when I just started in this second phase, which is solving hybrid planning problems where you actually wind up giving up on the assumptions, multiple assumptions together. Okay, so you wind up having time, concurrency, so concurrency, probabilistic effects, as well as uncertain, partially observable state. In many cases, in many of those cases, actually, one of the interesting things is the modeling itself, the search itself is tricky, okay? And heuristics come after you actually have the right search. And to put this in perspective, actually, I would like to point out that, as I mentioned, there's been a lot of work in temporal planning, and we recently found out that most of them, most of the good ones that are actually winning the competitions were solving non-temporal, I mean, so they essentially are doing non-temporal planning, but are able to essentially just use time as sort of a cost in the background. Okay, so as you start doing modeling of the hybrid planning problems, then we think actually these sorts of techniques can be extended. Okay, so let me end with a couple more slides. One is, why do we love PG heuristics? You know, they work. I think they seem to be working in across a variety of planners. And one of the things that I didn't get to do is that, you know, these sort of heuristics also work for regression planning as well as partial order planning, and there's work on it. Like, you know, Ichikai 2001 has a paper which shows how the same sort of heuristics can be used for partial order planners. Okay, I really like this. They're forgiving. You know, they just, you can basically cut corners any which way you want, and it does not affect the soundness of the planner. It can affect the efficiency of the planner, and it can affect the quality of the solution, and so in so doing, it can affect the completeness of the planner as a whole, but soundness is not affected. And so if you don't like doing mutexes, you don't need to do mutexes. If you feel like doing, one of the interesting things you can do is, suppose I can give myself only 5 seconds to compute and propagate mutexes. That's all I'm going to do. That's okay. That will give you 5 seconds worth of extra informedness. You know, it may not be, you know, qualitatively improved, but, you know, if I give you few extra mutexes that are in the planning graph, that improves your reachability estimate. Okay. Whereas if you're doing, you know, direct search on the planning graph, you don't have that sort of a luxury. There are certain minimum number of mutexes that you must mark, otherwise you won't get valid plans. Okay. And similarly, you don't like growing the graph all the way, that's fine. You know, stop wherever you feel like, and then that will give you, again, as I said, if you stop before level up, all you know is that if it hasn't appeared up to the level K, then it's at least K plus 1. Okay. Allows propagate many types of information, you know, level, sub-goal interaction, time, cost, world support, probability. We looked at a whole bunch of them. Supporting a phase relaxation, which is one other thing you can do is, as I said, you could ignore negative interactions first, do relaxed plan, and add a penalty to that number based on the negative interactions. Now, this idea can also be done for resources. Suppose you have problems where you have time and resources, okay, you might, which is continuous quantities, you might ignore continuous quantities first, do the relaxed plan with just the time, and then add a penalty to take into account the resource interaction. Okay, those kinds of ideas seem to work well. And then graph structure itself supports a lot of other synergistic uses. I told you earlier about how you can use just the actions in either the planning graph itself or the relaxed plan itself to cut down the branching factor. And one of the interesting things is this is a non-trivial, I mean, this plays a non-trivial role in the success of reachability heuristics. Okay, this is, you know, in the case of FF, for example, I think there's a large analysis that has been published, which shows that the cut down of the branching factor was just as useful as the reachability information. And then finally, I guess, it's sort of the versatility of the planning graph variations itself. You have different kinds of planning graphs, probably you're sick and tired of them by now. You have different kinds of propagation methods. You can propagate levels, mutex, cast, labels, and all sorts of stuff. And you can, in essence, use the same sort of reachability analysis with some broad unifying characteristics to a variety of planning problems, classical resource planning, continuous resources, temporal planning, conformant and probabilistic planning are the ones that I mentioned here, but there are others that are going on. Okay. And then it also is actually useful for a variety of planning search techniques too. One of the weird things is you can use level heuristics to help graph plan do better than the original graph plan. Okay, I mean, I don't have the slide here, but it turns out that the original graph plan can, you know, use to essentially have the, as I said, it extend the graph and look for the valid subgraph on that. The way it would do it is level by level search, and it can be seen as a sort of a dynamic constraint satisfaction problem, and the variable selection heuristic can be done using these reachability ideas, and it does better than graph plan. Okay, so basically any type of search that you're doing to find plans, it seems that some version of this planning graph sort of reachability heuristics is useful. This still doesn't mean that you should not look at any other type of heuristics, but this means that you should definitely think of planning graph-based reachability heuristics if you're trying to improve the performance of something, a planning search. Okay. So we will stop there, and if there are further questions, we'll take them. Otherwise, thanks for your attention. Yes?
Well, it's more like a comment or maybe even a fundamental challenge to your work. And it's about this goal of domain-independent heuristics.
Domain-independent heuristics.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there are two considerations. Sometimes it's domain-specific aspects that are exploited by people to be able at all to solve a certain planning problem. So it would be very stupid not to exploit this sort of speeding up the process. And there's a different aspect, so that's kind of the technical part of view. But also the different aspect, I mean, I'm very much into real-world applications, like constructing a plan for the workshop of Volvo trucks to
mm-hmm.
diagnose and repair their vehicles. And it turns out that in terms of the exactness of the result we are producing, there are some criteria, if they are not met, even if you could show your plan is more cost optimal than what they are doing, they don't accept that.
Yeah,
and very often for good reason,
yes.
One has to say. So the core of my argument is maybe, well, at least what is needed in addition is, let's say, a systematic way of expressing such domain or task class-specific information combined with the general heuristics.
So again, I completely agree. I don't think there is actually a controversy here. So in planning, okay, let me just go one step higher. I've talked about domain-independent planning and heuristics for domain-independent planning. There's also been a whole other part in planning community itself called knowledge-based planning, where in essence, apart from just the pure physics of the domain in terms of preconditions and effects, you provide some of the additional knowledge that is readily available. As you put it eloquently, it's kind of stupid to stop the expert from telling you what they want to give you. Okay, so the real question would be how do you use it? And this whole idea, there is a whole knowledge-based planning track that has been run in the international planning competition for at least 3 years. It's been stopped now. Where people have looked at what's the most natural ways of expressing easily available domain knowledge and then how to exploit it. There are two approaches that are actually kind of reasonably popular. I mean, they've done well in, they used to be either this or that planner which would win the knowledge-based planning track. One is by Fahim Bakers, who essentially talked about writing knowledge about which sequences of actions make sense and which sequences of states make sense, which sequences of states don't make sense. And then there is another one which is basically hierarchical task network, which sort of tells you a grammar of feasible, desirable solutions. Mm-hmm. Now, The interesting thing, there's a polemic paper that I have on my webpage, I can, you know, I'll point out to you, that we call, what is knowledge-based planning track actually computing? I mean, what is it evaluating? Because the issue ultimately is figuring out whether or not this knowledge that you are inputting to the planner is really easily available. And to do that, you essentially have to kind of do user studies where, expert user studies, where you ask, you know, is this actually easily available, okay? The second part of your question, can we combine both? So there is some knowledge that's available additionally, and then you throw this in. There are HTN planners that do reachability analysis now, okay? So that essentially brings them together. And similarly, there's work by Jorge Bayer. Is he here by any chance? Jorge Bayer and Sheila McElroy with Fahim Barker in last year's IIII, which essentially brings reachability heuristics to the Barker style of adding extra knowledge. So in the community, it's not the case that people are all just putting all their eggs in the domain independent planning. They are bringing it together. And in fact, when operations research people look at automated planning community, both of which solve very similar problems, they say, you know, why can't we just write all these things as cutting planes? You know, the real question is it easily available or not? And I think that's definitely, I do not want to take a stance that I would not want that knowledge. It's really a question of doing a systematic analysis of what sorts of knowledge is easily available. And so it's kind of stupid to ignore the knowledge that's easily available, but it's also wishful thinking to assume that what you might need will be available, you know. So that's very much, I think, in the spirit of current directions in the community. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, guys.